Radio Dub is on the air. Yes, this is your eclectically genial host, John Derbyshire, with news of the hour. This week's show is actually less eclectic than usual. This has been a great week for patriotic immigration reformers, and I want to give the topic full coverage. The newsmaker here has, of course, been Donald Trump, so I shall start with him. Listen to this. Quotes. Real immigration reform puts the needs of working people first, not wealthy globe-trotting donors. We are the only country in the world whose immigration system puts the needs of other nations ahead of our own. That must change. Here are the three core principles of real immigration reform. 1. A nation without borders is not a nation. There must be a wall across the southern border. 2. A nation without laws is not a nation. Laws passed in accordance with our constitutional system of government must be enforced. 3. A nation that does not serve its own citizens is not a nation. Any immigration plan must improve jobs, wages, and security for all Americans. End quotes. Those quotes are from Donald Trump's position paper on immigration policy, published last weekend. Let me say that again, just so you get it. A serious candidate for the Republican presidential nomination next year has put out a position paper calling for the enforcement of federal laws and for the federal government to place the interests of American citizens before the interests of foreigners. Glory! Hallelujah! What is truly amazing here is that anyone is amazed to hear such plain, basic principles of national sovereignty stated frankly by a political candidate. Mind the borders, enforce the laws, put your own citizens first. As Mark Krikorian said in a fine column over at the Center for Immigration Studies, quote, "The three principles the paper offers wouldn't even have to be articulated in a healthier society. Of course, immigration policy must be based exclusively on the interests of we, the people of the United States, not wealthy donors, not corporations, not union bosses, not big city politicians, and not foreign citizens. Their articulation is nonetheless useful as a way to flush out libertarian and leftist opponents of American sovereignty." End quote. Those of us who've been writing and saying these same things for a decade or more are whooping and hollering and throwing our hats in the air. At last, there is a candidate, an actual, credible presidential candidate, who gets it. Donald Trump has single-handedly upset the apple cart of official blather about immigration. The style of diction that Steve Saylor has called, quote, "comically mercenary fraud covered up by pious cant." The apples are rolling all over the street now, and the faithful minions of chambers of commerce racketeers, foreign governments, globalist bankers and ethnic lobbyists are scurrying and squealing all over, trying to get them back in the cart. Speaking as a political observer, this is the most fun I've had for ages. More popcorn! If patriotic immigration reform has a hero in Donald Trump, it also has a heroine. That would, of course, be Ann Coulter. Ann's book, Adios America, has been soaring through the bestseller lists. It debuted June 21st at number 2 on the New York Times hardback nonfiction list. 8 weeks later, it's still at number 16. That's a simply wonderful showing for a book that lays out in detail, with full supporting references, all the stupidity and dishonesty of our immigration system, displaying it all to public view. To take one small example at random, from 100 that I could have taken, you know how politicians come up on your TV screen, look you straight in the eye, and tell you that they support amnesty for illegal aliens, but only if the alien pays a fine, pays back taxes, and learns English? Well, that's all bogus. As soon as Congress passes amnesty, all those conditions will be dropped. How do we know this? Because we already had one amnesty. IRCA, I-R-C-A, that's the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986. IRCA had those fees, those fines, those requirements to pay back taxes, and yes, a requirement that the alien, and here I quote from the actual text of the IRCA law, Title 2, Section B, Subsection 1, Item uppercase D, Paragraph lowercase Roman 1, quote, uppercase Roman 1, meets the requirements of Section 312 relating to minimal understanding of ordinary English and a knowledge and understanding of the history and government of the United States, or, uppercase Roman 2, is satisfactorily pursuing a course of study recognized by the Attorney General to achieve such an understanding of English and such a knowledge and understanding of the history and government of the United States, end quote. What happened to those requirements? Let Anne tell us. Adios America, page 44, quote, the last amnesty was loaded up with fines, fees, back taxes, and English lessons for illegal aliens. Let's review how that panned out. English language requirement dropped by the INS. Fines dropped by the INS. Fees waived by the INS. Back taxes dropped by the IRS. End quote. That politician promising you those conditions and requirements for amnesty is lying, lying, lying. The conditions and the requirements will all be waived as soon as the amnesty program goes into effect, just as happened with IRCA 30 years ago. They are bogus, bogus, bogus. I urge you to read Anne's book if you haven't already done so. For those of us who've been toiling for years in these vineyards, it's wonderful to see the topic getting front page exposure at last. I can claim to be a 15-year veteran of patriotic immigration reform. That's how long ago I published my first article at vdare.com. Peter Bremelow was pruning the vines 8 years before that with his groundbreaking cover article, Time to Rethink Immigration, in the issue of National Review, dated June 22nd, 1992. Nothing in Anne's book is new to us. Indeed, we flatter ourselves that she got some of her facts from reading us, along with other sites exposing the current sham, sites like Center for Immigration Studies and Numbers USA. Immigration has been a niche interest, though, and those of us trying to bring it to the political front burner have been working, how shall I put it, in the shadows. as respectable opinion has for decades deemed any criticism of immigration policy to be motivated by malice and cruelty. Now the ice is breaking at last. A lot of the credit for that goes to Ann Coulter. Thank you, ma'am. It's not just the IRCA conditions that are bogus, and it's not just with illegal immigration that we have problems. Bogosity has seeped into every nook and cranny of the legal immigration system. Taking US visas, including settlement visas, taking them to be economic objects for which there is a demand and a supply, both the demand side, that's the demand by foreigners for entry into the USA, and the supply side, that's the administration of our immigration laws and procedures, both sides are deeply corrupted. The supply side gets most of the publicity because it happens here, or in our consulates and embassies abroad, under laws legislated by the Congress critters we vote for, and administered by our relatives, friends, and neighbours. The demand side needs looking at too, though. There is a blithe reliance throughout the immigration apparatus on what foreigners say to immigration officers, and on supporting documents they provide, on smudged, wrinkled forms printed in obscure languages and stamped for authenticity by underpaid provincial clerks in Laos or Ecuador or Senegal. For example, obviously we don't want to accept for settlement in the USA a person who has a criminal record in his home country. But how do we know? If we ask him, of course he'll say he doesn't. If we press him for documentary evidence, we're making ourselves hostage to the efficiency and incorruptibility of third world government clerks. Speaking as a person who has lived in the third world, believe me, you don't want to do that. Never mind the third world, in fact. Administrative procedures, even in the first world, can be perfunctory. 29 years ago, I married a citizen of the People's Republic of China. The authorities in her hometown insisted that, before they'd license the marriage, I had to show proof I wasn't currently married. There was a widespread belief in China at that time that foreign males who wanted to wed Chinese females were married men just looking to acquire concubines. At the time, I was a British citizen living in New York. I went to the British consul on Third Avenue and explained the situation. "No worries," said the consul. "I'll have a letter typed up. Do you mind waiting?" When his secretary came back with the letter, he took it from her, looked over it briefly, and said, "You don't currently have a wife in England, do you?" I replied, "No, of course not." "Right," he said, and signed the letter. That's the level of authenticity you get from a British consular official. Can you imagine how things go with the Laotian or Ecuadorian or Senegalese equivalents? The system is bogus all through, on the sending side and the receiving side. Some proportion of visas issued are genuine, but it's a small and dwindling proportion. As Ann Coulter amply documents, high proportions of people given refugee visas are not refugees. People admitted on family reunification visas are not family members. Guest workers displace Americans who are just as qualified. Indeed, in some recent cases, American workers have had to train their foreign replacements. as a condition of getting their severance packages. The entire immigration system is a lie. It's bogus, bogus, bogus. To quote the title of chapter 14 in Ann Coulter's book, every single immigration category is a fraud. Returning to illegal immigration, it's the same with politicians' promises to attach conditions and restrictions on amnesty. As happened with IRCA, the conditions and restrictions will blow away like leaves in the wind as soon as the politicians have delivered what the cheap labour lobbies and ethnic agitators want from them. Solution? A moratorium on all settlement above a low ceiling, I suggest 10,000 a year, for really compelling cases. Rigorous border security and visa control. Compulsory universal e-verify. An end to birthright citizenship. In short, the Trump plan. Let's take a glance at how the new openness on immigration is affecting the course of the Cold Civil War. That everlasting conflict between wise, moral, progressive good whites on one side and dumb, evil, reactionary, gap-toothed, redneck, hillbilly, bad whites on the other side. With minorities conscripted into feed the horses and dig field latrines when necessary. For illustrative purposes here, we can take the June 19th airing of Real Time with Bill Maher, a political talk show hosted by, of course, Bill Maher. Maher is one of the smirkers, along with Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. He's a champion of the good whites. His smirk, in fact his entire demeanour, says to bad whites, I see through your lies and pretense. You claim to be religious and patriotic, but I'm too smart for you. Your religion and your patriotism are just cover for the real interests of your wealthy puppet masters. If we good whites don't keep hard at work exposing you and keeping you off balance, you'll be reinstating slavery, massacring Indians, persecuting Jews, and invading Poland first chance you get. Well, something like that. Well, June 19th, Anne's book was just out, and Maher had her on the show to talk about it. To feed the horses, he'd shipped in some coloured folk. A fat, angry-looking black woman, and Congressman Luis Gutierrez, a Latino supremacist. Or as he says, a Latino supremacist, who is on record as saying, quote, I have only one loyalty, and that's to the immigrant community, end quote. Maher went for the race angle at the first opportunity. The fondest conceit of the good whites is that they are free of all racial prejudice, while bad whites are seething with animosity, yearning to bring back lynching and Jim Crow.
We didn't used to take people just because they live within walking distance. We used to have an immigration policy where we would choose the best in the world, and that was changed. This is a fairly recent policy.
We would choose the whitest in the world.
The studio audience loved that. They cheered and applauded. Just for the record, I am very reliably informed that the studio audience at a Bill Maher show is whiter than a Bernie Sanders rally. In fact, the audience for the June 19th show actually was a Bernie Sanders rally. Maher had had Sanders on earlier for a one-on-one interview. Further for the record, Bill Maher lives in Beverly Hills, California, whose population is 78.5% white and only 2.5% black. Perhaps President Obama's Fair Housing Initiative will even things out there. Congressman Gutierrez pointed out that a million Latinos... Oh, I beg your pardon. Latinos. A million Latinos come of age in the USA every year. To which Anne responded, so do 4 million whites. That's what we bad whites call a hate fact. And you could see that Anne's brow was dark with hatred as she uttered it. It is, nonetheless, something the Republican National Committee might want to ponder as they scrape Sheldon Adelson's shoe polish off their tongues. The black lady then got to speak.
I think one of the things that we have to do in this country is to stop lying. We were earlier talking and touched on the issue of slavery.
I make that 7.12 seconds of talk, including a pause for audience applause, before the black lady mentioned slavery. That shows extraordinary restraint on her part, for which I think we should congratulate her. She went on to argue that today's mass third world immigration is a modern equivalent of slavery, run by selfish corporate elites seeking cheap labour. Since Anne makes a similar argument in her book many times over, the black lady was revealing that she hadn't actually read the book that she'd been invited on primetime TV to discuss. Or if she had read it, she had utterly failed to understand what she read. The thought crossing Bill Mayer's mind at this point had to be, sheesh, you just can't get good help nowadays. Let's hope the black lady is at this point back to digging field latrines, which I'm sure she does very well. Congressman Gutierrez is no doubt back pursuing his one and only loyalty, whipping up La Raza against the hated gringos. Hey, Congressman, to judge from that studio audience, not even you hate white people as much as good white people hate themselves and their ancestors. You can watch the whole clip for yourself on YouTube, and I urge you to do so. I call it a clear victory for us bad whites, which is pretty sensational, as there was only one of us there and a whole studio packed with good whites. Long odds, but not too long for Anne, bless her. Just one more segment here on legal immigration. I quoted the true and illuminating title of Chapter 14 in Ann Coulter's book. Every single immigration category is a fraud. Yes, it is. This hasn't always been the case, though, at least not to anything like the current degree. If you don't mind, I'm going to lapse into personal memoir here to show what I mean. 30 years ago, in October 1985, I came to the USA from England on an H-1 guest worker visa. The H-1 had not yet speciated into the H-1B and H-1C. That happened in 1990. The financial deregulation of the Reagan years had woken Wall Street investment banks from their dogmatic slumbers. They were updating their computerized trading systems as fast as they could, and they needed experienced programmers and systems analysts. I was an independent consultant working in London, 6 month or 1 year contracts that I got through an agency. One day, my agent called and asked if I would do a contract in New York. I said I didn't see why not, if the fee was right. I was single, living in a rented apartment. It made no difference to me where I worked. There wasn't even a novelty factor to pull me. I'd lived in New York for 5 years in the 1970s. It was just another contract. The agent got me an interview. The interview went well. The New York firm hired me and got me a visa, an H-1. They hired a bunch of other Brits too. We all went over together in a batch, We all sat through the orientation drills together, and we got to know each other. The deal was for a one-year contract. If the firm liked your work, they'd extend your visa up to the limit, which for an H-1 was 6 years. If you thought you might want to settle permanently in the USA, they'd sponsor you for a green card. I'm pretty sure we didn't displace any American workers. The cubes and desks we were assigned were new, not vacated by previous workers. In fact, the firm was struggling to find space for us, parking people in storage rooms and corridors at 5 World Trade Center. For sure, no Americans were assigned to train us on pain of losing their severance packages. Our compensation was competitive for that time and place. I got $44,000 a year for that first year. Pretty good for that work in that time and place. When the visa extension and the green card stuff got going, I spent time with the company lawyers who were handling it all. They kept telling me that it was all conditional on them properly advertising for and not being able to find American workers as per government regulations. I actually saw some of the advertisements in trade newspapers. In the mid-1980s, as far as I could judge, the H-1 visa was on the level, not bogus. Furthermore, in that draft of people that I came over with, all of us on H-1 visas, at least half went back. They didn't want to stay in the USA. Some of them had family connections in the UK that they were missing. Some had just wanted a one-year taste of working in New York, a brief adventure. And some just couldn't make the cultural adjustment. That last one sounds a bit odd, I know. Cultural adjustment? Britain to America? Aren't we cousin nations speaking the same language? Well, not really. George Orwell said that England has a national culture as distinct and particular as Spain's. It sure is different in key respects from America's. There is, for example, the British addiction to understatement and irony, in which, here I'm quoting the 20th century British novelist Anthony Powell, in which all classes of this island converse, end quote. That doesn't work so well in the States. Don't take my word for it. Here's Jonathan Steinberg, professor of modern European history at the University of Pennsylvania, giving a set of lectures for the Great Courses Company. This particular lecture concerns the 19th century English novelist George Eliot. Professor Steinberg prefaces it with some remarks about British irony. Over to him.
Now here I speak from personal experience. I was an American who lived for nearly 40 years in England, and it may help here if we introduce J. Steinberg's double equation for understanding or explaining Anglo-American misunderstanding. It works like this. In England, the best thing you can be is amusing or clever, and the worst is tiresome or a bore. In America, the best thing you can be is sincere or genuine, and the worst is a phony. Now, if you put those values together, what you get is English amusing or clever equals American phony, and American sincere equals English bore. Now, this really works. I've tried it for years. I know it works. It's been really road tested.
I've taken it out for a spin myself a few times, and Professor Steinberg nails it. The Englishman, cherished by his friends for charm and wit, can come across to Americans as a frivolous phony. The American, revered by his friends as a paragon of wisdom and morality, strikes Englishmen as a smug bore. This isn't always the case, of course, but there is definitely a non-trivial cultural adjustment to be made. Some people can make it, some can't. Some can, but don't see why they should. Bear this kind of thing in mind when you hear about assimilation. If there are issues like that for English immigrants, imagine how it goes with immigrants from Afghanistan or Korea. Anyway, main point here. 30 years ago, the H-1 was a genuine guest worker visa. It wasn't cheap labour. American workers weren't displaced. The laws were honestly administered, and some high proportion of visa holders went back home after their spell of work. Now, the H-1, and as Anne says, every other visa category, is bogus, bogus, bogus. The issues we're having here in the USA with immigration arise in part from our own folly and inattention, but also in part from a worldwide phenomenon characteristic of the present age. In a nutshell, people living in poor, dysfunctional countries have discovered how easy it is to get into rich, stable countries. With TV and smartphones, they can see how good, how easy life is in the first world. Travel, if not always easy, is cheaper than ever before in human history. Most important, pretty much every third world nation now has seed communities in first world countries. The advance parties have been going out since the 1960s. Mainly at first to the old imperial powers like Britain, France and Holland. They set up communities there, got jobs and citizenship, and then they called to the folks back in Karachi or Algiers or Jakarta, "Hey, come on over, it's really great here." Immigration laws? Nah, don't worry, they don't enforce them much. So now, they're on the move in the hundreds of thousands and millions. Soon, if nothing happens to halt the phenomenon, in the tens and hundreds of millions. Happy talkers in the West say, "This is no problem. We need all these vibrant young third worlders to boost our economy," they say. Besides, once they see the wonders of consensual democratic government, they'll get on board with it right away and make model citizens. Just being here on our territory transforms them, like pixie dust, into exemplars of constitutional wisdom and civic virtue. There is not the slightest evidence for any of that. Sure, if you have more people, you have a bigger economy. As I keep trying to explain, though, along with addition, subtraction, and multiplication, there goes division. Bangladesh has a far bigger economy than Luxembourg's. As for good government, it takes centuries to get the hang of that, and quite likely requires some genetic predisposition. As always, here I pull down my high school copy of Taswell Langmead's English Constitutional History, 1946 edition. The main text fills 794 pages. How many pages could you fill for a book titled Syrian Constitutional History? Or Nigerian constitutional history? Or for that matter, Chinese constitutional history. Human beings live by wishful thinking, though. Most of us ignore danger until it becomes absolutely impossible to ignore it. Many English people of my parents' generation thought that Hitler was probably a decent sort of chap, right up to the moment that bombs started falling on London. So today in Europe, even with the daily pictures of boats crammed with Africans and Muslims, most Europeans are still lost in fantasies of moral obligation and Christian charity. See, for example, the cheerful opinion column by Charles Moore in the London Daily Telegraph the other day. The main point of the piece is that European unity is a fiction, and that EU members act in their own national interests, all of which is true. Moore can't resist a little immigration moralising, though. Sample quote. Politicians speak of wanting to make Britain a less attractive place. This is a very strange ambition. We are proud that Britain is attractive. Countries that are forced to build walls to keep people out are much better than those that build walls to keep them in. End quote. That last sentence is also true, except that the walls are not getting built. And Moore, who could be using his valuable space in a prestigious newspaper to sound the alarm, prefers to give that space over to moralistic preening. I've known Charles Moore for years. He was my editor at The Spectator when I was writing for him in the 1980s. He's an intelligent conservative, much more likely than most commentators to give you a sensible opinion on anything. Yet he is blithe about the hordes of blacks and Muslims who have already taken over London and whose fellow countrymen are massing on the shores of the Mediterranean and the English Channel to join the communities already planted in Britain. It's hard to see any good outcome to this. My best guess is that Europe is lost. The native populations are retreating in guilt and fear, just as Raspail foretold in The Camp of the Saints. 50 years from now, the British Prime Minister will be some black despot in a robe, carrying a fly whisk, handing out the nation's wealth to his wives and nephews and cousins, while remnants of the native population cower in fear in their gated communities, kept alive on sufferance, so that some semblance of economic activity can continue. It'll be South Africa, in other words. A vast historical tragedy is unfolding in Europe. We can only watch and grieve. The other day I was at lunch with a friend in a New York City restaurant. It was a nice lunch, and good to renew the acquaintance with my friend. My attention kept getting distracted, though, by a couple at a neighbouring table. A corner table. A man and a woman, both well-dressed and professional-looking, ages around 40. I couldn't hear anything they said, and of course I wouldn't have listened if I could, but there was something about their bearing and manner to each other that screamed adultery. Somehow they just gave off vibes of furtiveness and guilt. I can't pin down any more precisely than that what made me think so, but I'd have bet a fair sum of money there was adultery going on there. Hey, nobody's business but their own, and I'm not passing any judgments. It just seemed a bit quaint and anachronistic, like a 1940s movie. Brief encounter, perhaps. The topic of adultery came back to me, though, when I was going through the news sources later in the week. It seems there's this website named Ashley Madison, where people can go to arrange an adulterous liaison. Life is short. Have an affair, says the subheading on the title page. You are then invited to choose from a drop-down list. Attached male seeking females. Attached female seeking males. Single male seeking females. Single female seeking males. Male seeking males. Female seeking females. So, I guess it's not just for adultery. But that's what the site is famous for. It's pretty popular. 36 million people worldwide have registered with their names, addresses, credit card details, and sexual fantasies. Well, The news story is that an anonymous group of hackers calling themselves the Impact Team got into the website, stole 10 gigabytes of data, and made it public. They say they did it because the site is a fraud, drawing advertising revenue from gullible males who, according to the hackers, are 90 to 95% of the site's users, the females registered being mostly fake names. They want Ashley Madison users to prosecute the website's proprietors and claim damages. It all seems a bit odd to me. Why does A care that B is being taken for a dummy? Whatever. The dump of Ashley Madison data has caused worldwide panic among married people. And yes, it does seem to be mostly men, who registered on the site hoping to end up in an adulterous affair. I'm sure this tells us something about the times we live in, but I can't quite figure out what. I had better unmask myself here as a hopelessly married guy who has no interest in adultery. To be perfectly frank, I don't know how people find the time. If you ask me for an overall moral judgment on adultery, I guess I'd offer the conventional answer that, since family life is the foundation of civilization, and since adultery is disruptive of family life, I'm against it in a general way. That said, I've seen enough of the world to know that there is a spectrum of attitudes that couples can have towards each other's adulteries. Dr. Johnson said that marriage is a league at last of friendship, not of love. I think that's as true as any general statement about life ever is. It implies that the varieties of marriage are as wide as the varieties of friendship, which is pretty wide. I know couples whose marriage would be utterly and fatally destroyed by a partner's adultery. I know other couples who'd greet news about their partner's adultery with a shrug and a smile. I don't think I know any totally open marriages, but I've read enough literary biographies to know that they happen and can be stable and enduring. In cases where one partner loses interest in sex but the other doesn't, adultery is probably a better alternative than divorce. Even the element of deceit, which I think is where most of us would say the real moral turpitude lies, even that can be taken different ways by different people. I recall a female acquaintance of mine, sensible, well-educated and attractive, married 20 years, whose husband's work takes him away from home a lot. I recall her saying, "I don't care what he does, so long as I don't find out." As I said, a spectrum of attitudes, with the possibility, at least, of lasting, stable marriages at every point on the spectrum, along with, at most points, the other possibility of rancorous separation. Things used to be a lot more strict. Among the 19th century European bourgeoisie, they were very strict indeed. That must have been trying for persons inclined to adultery, but it was a great boon to lovers of good books, as we got at least three great novels out of it, each in a different European language. In French, Flaubert's Madame Bovary. In Russian, Tolstoy's Anna Karenina. And in German, Fontana's Effi Briest. The adulterous wives in all three books come to a sticky end. The husbands survive, but not happily. As Effi Briest's husband memorably says, reflecting on it all, "Mein Leben ist verpfuscht." My life is messed up. As traditionalist as I mostly am, I think that on balance, today's wider spectrum of marriage modes generates less human misery than the bourgeois norms of 150 years ago. Less chance of one's life ending up verpfuscht. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. The movie sensation of the week is Straight Outta Compton, a dramatised documentary about a black rap group in California. Believe it or not, I felt a mild stir of interest when I saw the name of that movie. I did an interview with Maureen O'Connor at the Good White website, Gawker.com, in 2012. At one point, she asked me about my musical preferences. Quote, "Are there any black American rap artists you like?" Personally, I always thought NWA's Straight Outta Compton had a good outlook on authority. Also, pro-gun. End quote. I should explain that NWA is the name of the rap group that the movie is about. I replied that, quote, "My musical tastes don't venture far from opera," end quote, and we dropped the topic. Always curious about good white fads, though, I looked up Straight Outta Compton, which at that point was just a song, not a movie. I looked it up on the internet. Sample lyrics. "Shoot a motherfucker in a minute. I find a good piece of pussy. I go up in it. So if you're at a show in the front row, I'ma call you a bitch or dirty ass hoe." Well, the lyricist does seem to have grasped the essentials of rhyme. But that aside, this is not stuff that I want to engage with. I like civilization, science, art, mathematics, music. This is not civilization. This is the barking of wild animals. I am, of course, aware that wild animals exist. At this very point in time, I'm sure, herds of caribou are migrating across the tundra, and panthers are stalking small primates through the jungle. These just aren't things that I'm interested in. So, no, I won't be seeing the movie. Item. From the New York Post, America's newspaper of record. August 17th. Headline. Ex-lover says Donald Trump was great in bed. That ex-lover is a certain Sandra Taylor, now 48 years old, who went on 3 dates with Trump 2 or 3 decades ago. Lisped Ms. Taylor to the New York Post, quote, "Oh my gosh, he was great. I think he'd be a terrific president." End lisp. You may laugh, but these things matter. Sarah Palin probably got further in politics than she would otherwise have done because so many of us saw her as a fertility goddess. For serious students of politics, a copy of The Golden Bough is not out of place on one's bookshelf. And for the political effect that a sexually assertive male has on female voters, consider the following fact. The 19th Amendment, giving all women the vote, was ratified in August 1920. The first presidential election after that ratification came in November that year. The winner of that election was, yes, Warren Harding, by a landslide. I'm just saying. Item. Finally, a passing sigh and a tear for 31-year-old Mr. Linton Gallimore of Plymouth in Devon, over in the mother country. Mr. Gallimore, who was actually South African by birth, went to join the Choir Invisible on August 4th after falling off a railroad bridge in South London. Mr. Gallimore had achieved a modest measure of fame in Plymouth for balancing upside down in public places with his head in a bucket. He had been doing this since 2009 and apparently making a decent living at it. In a world where automation is rapidly taking away all the real jobs, I think we should honour the memory of Mr. Gallimore as a pioneer in making a living for himself by doing something with no social utility whatsoever. Balancing upside down with his head in a bucket. Quote from his brother, Keegan Gallimore, quote, "He was the bucket man and a loving brother and very good man, who was not only hard-working, but a well-educated, South African-born human being." End quote. We should all hope for such a sincere, heartfelt tribute after we have kicked the bucket. That's all I have for you this week, ladies and gents. Thank you for listening, and thanks also for the emails. Here, I offer my periodic apology for not answering all my emails. It's just not possible, although I do my honest best. My promise, as before, is that every email not rude or illiterate gets read and pondered, even if not answered. And good ideas, interesting facts, and clever jokes get shamelessly plagiarised. Now, a snippet of music to see us out. Let's take adultery as our theme. Although I have no personal interest in adultery, I do, as regular listeners know, have an interest in 19th and early 20th century popular music. Here's a song from 100 years ago. The title of the song is Parted. And I believe it must surely be the greatest adultery lyric ever written. The singer here is Peter Dawson, who, according to his biographer John Vose, was even more of a stick-in-the-mud, marriage-wise, than your humble Radio Derb host. The same cannot be said of the lyricist, the impossibly talented, prolific and adulterous Frederick Weatherly, who also wrote Danny Boy, along with 3,000 or so other songs. More from Radio Derb next week.
I worship.